These voices made headlines this week.
The days may become months, and the months may become years, but we will stay as long as aggression commands us to battle.
India's faith in peace is unshaken.
We reviewed a multiplicity of problems that affect our world.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, the sounds of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Glenn Riggs with Voices in the Headlines.
Let me be absolutely clear. The days may become months, and the months may become years, but we will stay as long as aggression commands us to battle.
The voice of President Johnson speaking to a joint session of Congress Wednesday night. In his third State of the Union message, the president repeated United States' determination to stay in South Vietnam, but he warned that the fighting could continue.
We may have to face long, hard combat or a long, hard conference or even both at once until peace comes or if it does not come, our course is clear. We will act as we must to help protect the independence of the valiant people of South Vietnam.
While reaffirming the U.S. intention to stand firm in Vietnam, President Johnson made it clear that he will continue the search for peace. As for the recent peace missions overseas, the president said,
"We have asked and hoped, and we've waited for a response. So far, we have received no response to prove either success or failure."
Before President Johnson spoke to Congress, there was some speculation that he would announce cutbacks in his Great Society program to pay for the expanding war in Vietnam. But Mr. Johnson made it clear that there was no simple choice between guns and butter.
Time may require further sacrifices. And if it does, then we will make them. But we will not heed those who wring it from the hopes of the unfortunate here in a land of plenty.
The president asked Congress to pass a series of domestic reforms, including additional guarantees for Negroes and a four-year term for members of the House of Representatives. To pay for the Vietnam War, President Johnson asked Congress to put back the excise taxes on new cars and telephone service. After the president's message, congressional reaction was mixed. House Speaker John McCormick said,
"I think it's a historic message. I think that history will note that President Johnson tonight reaffirmed his faith in the future, and that with the wholehearted support of the American people and our allies and the free world, we can go forward to prove that the president's faith was justified."
But Republicans thought the president left a lot unsaid. House Minority Leader Gerald Ford.
"All Americans and people throughout the world were hopeful of more specifics as to what we might expect in the way of meeting the challenge, rather than to simply reaffirm what I think has been our government's policy in Vietnam for the past several years."
In his speech, President Johnson called for increased trade with Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. But Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen thinks this would be a mistake.
"The countries of Eastern Europe are doubtless the main suppliers of the Viet Minh forces and are using those supplies, obviously, in order to destroy young American soldiers."
On Thursday, President Johnson held an unexpected news conference at the White House, his first since last August. and the president spoke of Viet Cong activity in South Vietnam.
The number of incidents have dropped off some. I don't say that there's any connection with that and our peace moves, but that is a fact.
President Johnson also said he will keep sending ambassadors overseas in an effort to bring the Vietnam War to the conference table. One of those ambassadors was still visiting foreign capitals this past week. Diplomatic troubleshooter Averill Harriman stopped in Australia and Thailand before flying to Saigon and talks with Secretary of State Rusk and Vietnamese leaders. Secretary Rusk and Premier Ky issued a joint communique on their talks. Before flying to Manila, Mr. Rusk explained,
"We have issued a communique which summarizes the our discussion here. It should be quite clear that South Vietnam and the United States are working in closest harmony to resist aggression and to restore a peace and tranquility and prosperity to this great country."
While Secretary Rusk was in Vietnam, little gunfire was heard, a possible indication that at least a partial Lunar Year truce may have arrived early. During this past week, some 8,000 U.S. and Australian troops completed Operation Crimp, the massive hunt for communist guerrillas along the Iron Triangle northwest of Saigon. Fewer than 200 communists were killed in the sweep, but the Americans destroyed a maze of Viet Cong tunnels, a network of tunnels large enough to hide an entire division. Meantime, along the Cambodian border, the hunt continued for Viet Cong infiltrators. ABC's Ray Maloney talked with Colonel L.V. Roberts, commander of the 1st Cavalry's 1st Brigade. As helicopters roared in the background, Colonel Roberts told Maloney,
"We know they are coming into Vietnam from some outside area, and one of my jobs is to find out where they are coming in."
That's then the basis of this whole operation that's going on here, to screen, search the area, find the trails, and try and block them.
That's correct, to find where they are and destroy them if we can find them.
In the air, American B-52s from Guam continued pounding suspected Viet Cong positions in South Vietnam. And for the first time, correspondents were allowed to make the trip. Among them, ABC's Piers Anderton, who described the bombing run.
Five, four, three, two, one, zero.
Bombs away.
Bombs are being released.
All the bombs going on the target, right?
Roger, bombs are coming, Chuck.
Roger.
The bombs were dropped. The plane bucked slightly, and in 32 seconds, this 12-hour mission was over. That was all it was to us, a slight jumping of the plane. What it was on the ground, we may never know.
While U.S. planes continued bombing South Vietnam, the suspension of bombing attacks on North Vietnam entered its third week. As the week began, Yale professor Stoughton Lind and two companions returned from a trip to North Vietnam. At New York's Kennedy Airport, Professor Lind told of his talks with North Vietnamese Premier Pham Van Dong.
"The NLF and DRV require as a precondition to negotiations an unambiguous decision by the United States to withdraw all its troops from Vietnam. Every indication is that there is no explicit requirement of the physical withdrawal of all United States troops prior to negotiations."
And in Algiers, Viet Cong sources indicated that if the U.S. recognized the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong would drop their demand that American troops get out of South Vietnam. In Washington, the White House confirmed that a direct message had been given to North Vietnamese diplomats, but there had been no answer.
"India's faith in peace is unshaken. With us, it is a matter of principle and not of expediency. But adherence to peace does not and cannot mean that we should not take up arms to defend ourselves when attacked."
Lal Bahadur Shastri, the 61-year-old Prime Minister of India, who had flown to the Soviet city of Tashkent to discuss the Kashmir dispute with Pakistan's President Ayub Khan. Acting as mediator at the summit talks, Soviet Premier Kosygin. On Monday, Shastri and Ayub agreed to pull back their troops to where they were before the Kashmir fighting last summer. They also agreed to exchange prisoners and continue efforts to find a settlement of their differences. But a few hours after the agreement had been signed, India's Prime Minister Shastri was dead, victim of a heart attack. In New Delhi, Home Minister Nanda was sworn in as acting Prime Minister. Nanda promised to support the agreement signed by Shastri and Ayub. In Washington, White House News Secretary Bill Moyers read President Johnson's reaction to Shastri's death.
Lal Bahadur Shastri, in only 19 months in office, proved a fitting successor to Pandit Nehru by holding aloft the highest ideals of Indian democracy. His modesty in high office did not conceal his strength and wisdom as the recognized leader of his people.
And former American ambassador to India, Senator John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky.
The death of Prime Minister Shastri comes at a very difficult time for India with all its problems, and his death is a great loss to the Indian government and its people.
Senator Cooper flew to New Delhi along with Secretary of State Rusk and Vice President Humphrey to attend the Shastri funeral. The body of the Indian Prime Minister was flown home to New Delhi aboard a Soviet plane. On Tuesday, thousands of Indians lined the streets and filed past the Shastri bier. On Wednesday, representatives of foreign governments gathered beside the sacred Jumna River as Shastri's son lighted the funeral pyre. Among those eulogizing the Indian leader was Vice President Humphrey, who spoke of Shastri's trip to Russia.
He made great strides in the pursuit of peace. And he knew to win the peace required courage and perseverance. Yes, your late and beloved Prime Minister Shastri knew that peace is the highest goal of civilized man.
After the funeral, Mr. Humphrey and Secretary Rusk met for more than 2 hours with Soviet Premier Kosygin. When he arrived back in Washington on Friday, the Vice President commented on his talks in New Delhi.
We discussed events at Tashkent in some detail again, and we reviewed a multiplicity of problems that affect our world and the relationships between our two countries. This is a part of a continuing discussion between officials of the government of the United States and the Soviet Union.
On Monday, a march on New York City Hall. More than 10,000 members of the Transit Workers Union and their sympathizers marched outside City Hall demanding that Union President Mike Quill be released from the hospital. Quill had been hospitalized after being jailed for contempt in calling the transit strike. On Monday night, New York Mayor Lindsay announced he would ask his mediators to recommend a solution to the crippling strike, which was already being felt across the country. Talks broke down on Tuesday, but the next day, union negotiators called their top leaders to a conference, indicating that a settlement was near. The next morning, Mayor Lindsay announced,
New York's transit strike is over. A new contract between the Transit Authority and the striking unions was agreed to in the early hours of this morning.
Welcome news for New Yorkers who were tired of walking. A few hours after the settlement was announced, New York's 600 subways and 4,100 buses began rolling again, the first time in 12 days. New Yorkers were riding again, but the economic effects of the transit strike would be felt for some time. Mayor Lindsay.
The strike cost New Yorkers upwards of $500 million in just 12 days. More than $200 million worth of paychecks were never issued. Retail sales plummeted 50 to 75%.
Mayor Lindsay said the new agreement would cost about $52 million, but the union said it was more like $70 million. In Washington, President Johnson was unhappy with the transit agreement.
The settlement, I am informed by the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, violates our national guideposts for non-inflationary wage increases, and I do not believe that any settlement that violates the guidepost to this extent is in the national interest.
At his news conference Thursday, President Johnson announced the end of a long talent hunt. The hunt for a man to head the new cabinet-level Department of Housing and Urban Development. The president announced,
after looking over these potential candidates, after carefully reviewing the proposed operations and of the department, its functions, as well as its organization, I came to the conclusion that the man for this job is Mr. Robert Weaver.
The 58-year-old Weaver has been administrator of the Housing and Home Finance Agency since 1961. If confirmed by the Senate, Robert Weaver would become the first Negro to sit in the cabinet. A former cabinet member, Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut, said of Weaver's appointment,
I think it's an outstanding choice. Secretary Weaver is a man of great ability, imagination, and dedication. I am sure that he will do an outstanding job in heading up this new department.
In Atlanta, Georgia, the State House of Representatives opened its 1966 session with a debate over whether to seat one of its members. 25-year-old Representative-elect Julian Bond, a Negro, had endorsed a statement denouncing U.S. policy in Vietnam. Bond didn't urge young men to burn their draft cards, but said he admired the courage of those who did. Former State Representative Denmark Groover, the lawyer for those House members challenging Bond's right to a seat, questioned Bond before a House committee, and Bond answered the charges.
I do not advocate that people should break laws. What I simply tried to say was that I admired the courage of someone who could act on his convictions, knowing that he faced pretty stiff consequences.
Later that day, committee chairman William Wiggins reported the committee's decision to the full House.
Based upon testimony and evidence and documents before this committee, the committee recommends that Representative-elect Julian Bond not be allowed to take the oath of office as a member of the House of Representatives, and that he not be seated as a member of the House of Representatives.
The Georgia House voted 184-12 that Julian Bond be barred from a seat in the House of Representatives. Bond promised to take the case to federal court. Then on Friday, outside the state Capitol building in Atlanta, a thousand Negroes marched on the Georgia state capitol in support of Julian Bond. In a speech outside the Georgia capitol, Dr. Martin Luther King said of the action against Bond,
certainly there is no legal or moral way to justify the state legislature's refusal to seat Julian Bond.
The sounds of protest this past week in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Some 200 Negroes attended a church rally to protest the killing of Vernon Dahmer, a Negro civil rights worker. The 58-year-old Dahmer died of burns suffered when night riders firebombed his home and store. At the church rally Monday, the Negroes heard from NAACP State Field Secretary Charles Evers.
The Negroes have been mistreated. They have been beaten and their homes have been bombed and burned ever since we've been here. And you talk about justice in Mississippi.
Another civil rights march was held this week in Birmingham, Alabama. On Monday, several hundred Negro students began throwing rocks at policemen as the students were on their way to a voter registration rally. The police fired shots into the air to break up the demonstrators. On Thursday, police used nightsticks to break up a parade of marchers protesting voter registration procedures in Birmingham. During the march on City Hall, ABC's Jim Burns talked with Negro leader Fred Shuttlesworth.
Reverend Shuttlesworth, how would you describe conditions here in Birmingham?
Well, I describe them as sort of being at the near explosive stage where the policemen have begun to unleash their violence and terrorism, which was current during the 1963 demonstration.
A hint of more trouble to come in Birmingham, Alabama. In Washington, the House Un-American Activities Committee focused on the activities of the Ku Klux Klan in Louisiana and Mississippi. An alleged leader of the Mississippi Klan was accused of plotting to blow up Mrs. Lyndon Johnson's campaign train in 1964, but he refused to answer questions. Were the hearings doing any good? Committee member Charles Weltner of Georgia told ABC,
I believe that this investigation is proving to be an effective weapon to deal with the violent activities that have resulted in so much misery to so many people.
In Beverly Hills, California this past week, a daring kidnap attempt failed. Police had been alerted that an attempt would be made to kidnap millionaire industrialist Leonard Firestone, president of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company's California division. But when the alleged kidnappers appeared at the Firestone home, police were waiting for them. A Beverly Hills police spokesman told what happened.
They came rushing in. Both of them were armed, and they busted in with the guns drawn and with the past records on these subjects of robbery with violence. The officers were not taking any chances.
Both of the alleged would-be kidnappers were killed. One of them was the man who had reportedly masterminded the kidnap attempt and later tipped off police. Meantime, Leonard Firestone, who had been asked by police to leave town, commented on the plot to kidnap him.
Naturally, this was a very distressing and upsetting thing to have gone through. I can't praise the police too highly. They did a thorough job, intelligent, and really a masterful piece of work.
British Prime Minister Harold Wilson told a conference of Commonwealth nations in Lagos, Nigeria this week that the economic sanctions were beginning to have an effect on the rebellious Rhodesian government. The Commonwealth ministers supported Britain's stand in the dispute. British Commonwealth Secretary Arthur Bottomley was to go to Salisbury this week, but the trip was canceled. Back in London, Prime Minister Wilson explained,
I had hoped, and he had hoped, that he could have gone for urgent and important talks with the governor, who is the legal government of Rhodesia, but the Smith regime of him. Those conditions which would involve the recognition of the regime, which we cannot, of course, accept, nor does the world accept it, and which might, and which seemed to cast doubts on whether they could be responsible for his safety and security.
A few days after the Lagos conference, the army took over the Nigerian government in a sudden coup, kidnapping the country's prime minister. In New York, a former prince in Tsarist Russia had a comment on the transit strike. Said the prince, if you survived the Russian Revolution, you could survive the transit strike. All we had to do during the strike was walk. In 1917, we had to run. So went this world, this week, and the voices in the headlines.
Voices in the headlines. A presentation of ABC Radio News, written and produced by Ted Whitcomb, directed by Bill Gately, executive producer Tom O'Brien, production staff Gene Carlson, Len Hirschfield, and Cy Katrowitz, special effects Bob Ring, your narrator Glenn Riggs. This is Les Griffith inviting you to keep up with the news every hour of every day on this ABC radio station, and to catch up with the news each week on Voices in the Headlines.